Hello, and welcome to Parallel Lives, where every episode, myself and my co-adventurers report back to you on a new and different system of role-playing. This week, the Dreadcast, by which I mean we're looking at the 2004 RPG by Epidira Voltrell and Nathaniel Barmore, published by The Impossible Dream. Be warned, though, all you who venture within, the sound quality on this episode is a little on the dreadful side. I wish I could say that was an intentional on-theme decision, but it was actually much stupider. I blame psychics. If you stick with us, though, I promise, the system is exciting, rewarding, and unique.
Hello. My name is Dr. Mercurio Arborea, and I am the founder of the Arborea Institute. Through our unique blend of benign pharmacology, sensory therapy, and energy sculpting, we can guide you to a new, better, happier you.
Today I am joined by Olivia S. and Shannon, as well as Charles and Olivia D. The game was run by Olivia D. in this case. Since you two are new to the podcast, you want to introduce yourselves?
I'm Olivia D. I have been role-playing since I was about 15, I think. D&D 3.5 was my first. Since then, I've played some 4th edition, I've played some homebrew systems, I've played a lot of Silver Age Sentinels. I'm trying my hand as hard as I can at, you know, my GM and skills.
I'm Charles. I'm an intermittent role player at best, a background in mostly 3 and 3.5. I've played fewer games than I've helped design. My brother was a fairly avid GM for his school friends, and while I never felt like playing with any of them, I would frequently help him lay out encounters and campaigns and plots. Helped Olivia D. actually with the Silver Age Sentinels campaign that she just talked about.
Yeah, it's not unfair to say that we co-GM'd that campaign.
3.5 Deadlands and a 3.5 variant set in the Iron Kingdoms, which is, I think, primarily a miniature setting.
There's a fucking great intro, man.
You'll listen to ours from last time, and they're much worse.
Yeah. Lower the bar.
Did you remember to address everyone out there in Radioland?
No, everyone out there in
Radioland. And all the ships at sea?
No, but we'll work
on it. This is
it.
Never going to succeed.
Don't worry, I'll cut that part so no one will know.
And splice that into the last episode.
Look, I can do anything.
Our boys in blue need to know that they're included.
Bram, what does the stranger know?
What?
The shadow.
Oh, the shadow. Yeah, no, the shadow knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men. Thank you. And then if I was Orson Welles, I would do a crazy laugh. Thank you for putting up with us, listeners, and our boys at sea. As you may have gathered, Dread is a role-playing game based around horror, usually. Although it's possible you can do other stuff with it.
Suspense is not a bad idea.
Yeah, fair enough. Horror and suspense. It is built for one-shots, and the main thing that sets it apart from other systems is that instead of using dice as your skill mechanic, you use a Jenga tower. And what that means is whenever you want to do something, if it is important enough, if the host, is that what the DM is called?
Host, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's actually a uniquely good term for the GM, host.
Well, if the host decides that they need to do a skill check, they do a pull from the tower, or maybe they do two if it's something especially challenging for their character. If they succeed, then everything is cool. It goes on through. If the tower falls, then their character dies or is otherwise permanently removed from the game.
Everybody uses the same Jenga tower, and you can at any point abandon a pull, but if you abandon a pull, you have failed. And, you know, there may be some negative consequences of failure.
We should also talk about punching the tower, which is the third option for any given pull.
You don't have to literally punch it.
But you should, for flavor reasons.
It's encouraged.
If at any point you do not feel that you're able to make a pull, instead of attempting to succeed and risking the possibility of failure, you can opt to fail grandly.
Like a heroic sacrifice.
Yeah, a heroic sacrifice. You will succeed, but your character will die or otherwise be removed from the game. You go out, in essence, in a blaze of glory.
When the tower falls, for any reason, it is then rebuilt, and you remove 3 Jenga pieces for every character in the game below 5. Any time you have lost a character, you lose 3 pieces.
As you might guess from this system, there is a very physical element to the game, suspense, that at least ideally tracks along with the story as you're playing, so things become more dangerous as you go along, and you have to do more and more things. And we can talk about in a moment how that works for us. But the other thing that makes Dread unique, I think, is its character sheets. And I know, actually, Olivia D., you were the one most excited about these.
They are one of my favorite things about Dread. I think that there are a lot of things that are really tricky about them, but I also think they're super cool. Dread is a completely diceless system, so any, like, character creation and development is not going to use any dice at all. The host prepares a 13 or so questionnaire that builds the character from the ground up. What I did is I also assigned the character's role. We had an acrobatic teenager and, like, a middle-aged roboticist, for example, played by Bram and Charles, respectively. And all of the players chose their roles, and then, you know, the next step in character development is this questionnaire. And the questionnaire contains, like, what are your skills, what are you truly good at, what are you afraid of, and, like, what are your reasons for hope and strength? And I love this because some of the questions get to be just, like, really interesting and really leading. Like, one of my favorite examples from the book is, why on earth did you think that you could get away with it, and how did you? And they're all just, like, open-ended questions like that, that, to my mind, make a player think and make it really easy for players to just pull characters out of nowhere that are surprisingly fully fledged and developed.
Characters with variation and texture and a secret flaw and a hidden agenda and something that they fear and something that they don't fear. A reason to be interested in the people around them, or a reason to distrust them.
Yeah, and a reason...
Hopefully
a reason,
right out of the box.
Yeah, and a reason not to give up as well. The manual is very, very clear on, like, nah, this is a game where hope is a fundamental mechanic. Because you always hope you're going to make a pull, and so your characters should be imbued with hope as well.
I will say about the questionnaire mechanic of character creation is that it is not very transparent. I personally, when writing my character, would have done it completely differently had I known a lot of the implications behind the questions. I played the nurse, and my character was a little too normal. I didn't flesh her out enough because I didn't quite grasp a lot of the implications of the questions. Like, I think there was a question along the lines of, what skill will you fall back on if you are fired? And I Olivia D. actually had to correct me on this one, because my initial answer was something along the lines of, I won't do anything. I need to hold on to my job. And she was like, oh, you know, this is a backup skill for you besides nursing. And I will admit that I did not read the game manual before playing, so perhaps that would have elucidated me a little bit.
Yeah, and I definitely think that that was my fault. Cause I also was misleading in that, like, I said to the players, like, please have someone who is relatively normal. Malkavians need not apply. Because I was trying really hard to be like, okay, please don't just play, like, someone who is, like, completely out there and off the wall and deeply strange. But I didn't say the other half of it, which was, like, but it would be really helpful and really great if you did make someone who is, like, flawed and troubled in ways that people are flawed and troubled, but, like, still flaws and troubles.
Yeah. No, my character Hester was a very, perhaps, too normal person. She liked biking and was okay at her job, and that was about it. And I wish I had done it differently. How did you feel about character creation, Shannon?
Yeah, oh, Shannon, you can talk.
Yeah. I don't know. I enjoyed it. I went with a character that was on 7th Heaven. I went with Eric Camden, and I was super happy with that. I just used his archetype to make the spiritualist character. And I found that pretty fun. What's up?
For the record, too, when we were talking about the heroic sacrifice earlier, it was Shannon's character that did end up doing a heroic sacrifice at the end.
Because the tower was getting really jankety, and it was late, so it had to be done.
Yeah.
I'll say that a lot of our sessions take place at night, so as they go on, things do get a little hairier. I would say as it reaches, I think we played until midnight?
Yeah.
I was
not very late.
Four choices this character by then.
And that was definitely another thing that I learned from this session, and that if I were to do Dread again, or even, like, any old horror game again, that I would try to do better. So the structure of this game was that it was divided into three parts. So our heroes wake up in this, like, weird semi-futuristic institute, and they have been kidnapped and moved to this location, and they don't know what it is or what's going on, and they've definitely been drugged. So the first phase is an exploration phase, where characters are just looking around and trying to figure out, where am I? What's happening? why is no one here, and so on and so forth. And then in the second phase, they encounter the monsters, and the monsters pull them into what in my notes are referred to as
the Mind Cathedral.
And they have, you know, mental adventures there. And I definitely let the exploration phase go on for way too long. I put the monsters, basically, in a place where the characters could see them and knew that they were there. And so they looked at that and they were like, oh, I'm going to avoid these at every cost. And, of course, the game relied upon them encountering those monsters.
Yeah, they were in a position that was visible to us. In fact, literally in a glass box. Literally in a glass box in our way.
An atrium.
A glass box. We were on the second floor of the facility. They were in a glass box on the first floor. Atrium. And we kept trying to find a way to navigate past them or not to get to them, because they were very clearly the threat.
I was thinking, like, well, they're going to have to encounter them eventually, because that's the only place that they can really go. So, but I should not have thought that. I should have.
Now, we're going to encounter them eventually, once we've done every kind of preparation that the GM will let us do in order to make our odds better against them. Which led to, like, an additionally frustrating moment, in which that preparation comes to exactly naught, because the only route the plot was ready to take was we come up against these, our monsters in this case are super powerful psychics, and are instantly sucked into the
Mind Cathedral.
Nothing we could do would actually affect the progress to Act 2.
Nah, you're going into that Mind Cathedral.
It's true.
Despite the fact that we could see the monsters right off the bat, though, the atmosphere was really creepy, which was enjoyable. I know I'm a sort of fan of the sort of medical horror, that genre that we played in, and I think that our host did, you know, an excellent job of keeping things the right blend of mysterious and, you know, ominous. And usually in horror, when you show the monster right off the bat, it really isn't scary, because you know, it's the Stephen King quote, you know, you show someone a giant spider and they're relieved, because, well, at least it wasn't an even bigger spider. But in this case, it was like a menacing, like a shark fin in the distant waters, where we knew that they were there and there was no way to escape it. Like, we're gonna have to go into that water. We have to get ourselves a bigger boat.
Also, because of the nature of psychics as your central monster, even if we could see them, they were always spiders of indeterminate size. Mm-hmm. We were not clear on whether they could, you know, tear us apart with a thought or merely cause us discomfort or what. Their powers, in fact, were they advanced the plot, but we weren't sure how that would go.
I mean, they also could have... They wanted to absorb your mental energy.
This is the point at which we're beginning to talk about the particular setting. It might be worth mentioning, just for, like, you know, all the folks at home and the boats at sea, that there is, like, a two-minute primer on what setting we were working in, and that is there is a movie trailer that you at home can watch for a film called Beyond the Black Rainbow, which is... The film itself is merely good. The trailer, we happen to think, is excellent. But if you want to see approximately what genre we were working in, distilled into two well-soundtracked minutes, just Google the trailer for that film and watch it on YouTube. And that will give you an idea of what we are working in.
It's basically like vintage, culty, transhumanist, hippie nonsense.
Again, even though the setting was influenced by an existing work of fiction, it felt unique to me. That might have been my non-familiarity with the
obscure piece of fiction.
There's a safety in picking a not terribly popular movie.
Charles, who had seen the film, knew, like, right off the bat, he was like, oh, are you just doing Beyond the Black Rainbow? And I was like, yeah.
And to her credit, like, the plot of the session was not the plot of the movie, but, like, the combination of, like, 70s new religious movements and cults, overtones of Scientology's love of goofy acronyms, third eyes and curly and photography all made appearances, pharmacology as mind expansion and also gateway to next level of human consciousness.
The phrase energy sculpting.
Yeah, what if hippies made a mental hospital in which they tried to make us all into great transcendent beings? Like, that was the sort of movie we were working in. It is really, like, a synthesis of multiple cool streams in, like, culture and fiction.
There were a lot of lobotomies. There aren't any lobotomies in Beyond the Black Rainbow.
Yeah. To be clear, though, energy sculpting is my day job.
Yeah, Ramage actually a really good energy sculptor.
That said, while we were talking a little bit earlier about the atmosphere of the piece, one thing that I think really helped with that was that Olivia D. put together a pretty expansive soundtrack. We went for like 4 hours, at least 4 hours.
No. It went for, I think, like...
Or did it loop?
It looped.
Okay, I can tell.
No, it was just, like, it was all, like, okay, pro tip, if you're ever GMing a horror campaign, use Aphex Twin. Just use Aphex Twin. No, my soundtrack was entirely, like, Aphex Twin that I exhaustively listened to. And actually, the soundtrack of Beyond the Black Rainbow. It was a little more than 2 hours long.
I found your decision to use just Bucephalus Bouncing Ball for an hour straight really odd, but, like, I thought it worked out.
You're making a joke that no one understands.
This is the part of the podcast where we lie to you, listeners. I hope you're ready for it.
I think that joke went over...
Yeah, no. It's a joke that no one got.
That one's for someone else out there who likes Aphex Twin a lot. That is, if anyone needs that joke explained, that is a soundtrack that you would never use for a horror game. It is a very silly-sounding Aphex Twin track.
There are a lot of really silly-sounding Aphex Twin tracks. You will have to...
Made a lot of jokes. And has made a lot of jokes that happen to be music.
It's true.
So do we want to talk about the way that the system works? Because Dread pretty much stands or falls.
Shut up, Charles.
Based on the efficacy of that central mechanic. And I have a lot of thoughts on it, and I assume other people do as well.
Yeah, I do, actually. Yes, we can move into that segment right now. If you like.
So the first thing I noticed is that it does function to ramp up tension over the course of a session, but... you need to have some way of ensuring that pulls happen often enough in the early stages that you have a shitty, horrible tower by the time that the high-stakes stuff is happening. And then, once the high-stakes stuff is happening, you should probably consider no longer making pulls for mundane things that you might even have asked for pulls for in the beginning. So, through the early section, the exploration section, Act 1, that we've already talked about, basically you could make a pull to closely examine a room. Call it a spot check. So that ensured that as we went through spaces, we were examining rooms and weakening our tower in order to get information about what was going on.
Finding the proper brilliant photography that would tell you, like, oh, these people actually have psychic powers.
Yeah. In Act 2, where we were all basically having a personalized face your demons moment, we're making pulls to deal with the existential horror of our life, or cope with the death of a loved one that we have been pushing down and designing robots to get around, in the case of my character. Towards Act 3, which was, we have escaped from the Mind Cathedral, now we must face down the psychics in the real world.
Yeah, Act...
and escape, once and for all.
Yeah, Act 3 is just, like, get the fuck out of Dodge.
I watched Bram's character make a pull to scramble into a vent, traverse between two rooms. And I was like, oh, she could die here. Like, major menace, psychic powers, cosmic consciousness, and lethal fear are in play right now, and we might lose a character to a vent scrambling error. And like, that's gonna be terrible.
I mean, it is possible, these being psychic characters, I would scramble through the vent and they would hear me, and then I would be dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another interesting and challenging thing about being the host for a Dread game. Is that characters can die at any moment. If somebody bumps the table while the tower is live, like, ha ha ha, you're dead. Or you're removed from the game. So you have to figure out, like, if this person fails this pull in this moment where nothing threatening is happening, how do I remove them from the game? And, like, for Bram, when she was scrambling through the vents, like, oh, the vent was gonna collapse and you were gonna have, like, gnarly, like, gruesome death in that way.
I know you mentioned, Olivia, during the game that there was a dead man walking mechanic. Do you want to talk
about
that?
There is a dead man walking mechanic, but it is not one that we used in the game, and it's not one that I have used. Basically, if really early on your character is killed, the host looks at that situation and goes, like, well, this really sucks. You know, this sucks for you because you can't play the rest of the game, and, like, maybe I'm not totally prepared to kill you or to remove you from the game right now. What you can do is rebuild the tower and have that character, like Olivia S. was saying, be a dead man walking, which is to say, basically, like, oh, I can't remember all of the rules. I think they might not be allowed to make pulls. I think they're almost certainly not allowed to attack other players, because Dread is in a lot of ways a fundamentally cooperative game because you're always using the same power. So if you want to attack somebody else and have them not automatically dodge if they want to, you have to have a pull-off, which is obviously extremely dangerous for everyone involved. I think Dead Men Walking are not allowed to do that. But the other thing about a Dead Men Walking is that the host can, at any time, just be like, oh, you're dead now, by the way, and, like, take control of that character and kill them for, you know, any thematic reason. So, you know, you got the sword of Damocles floating over your head.
Felt like one of the problems we had during the long exploration phase was a lack of fear regarding the tower. And at least, for me, I made a lot of pulls. I felt like I was making a lot of, most of the pulls, at least in the very beginning, to search the rooms, and that didn't, there wasn't really anything super tense about it, because if you've played Jenga, you know that there are a lot of blocks right at the beginning that are essentially not supporting the tower at all. Which was appropriate for sort of mundane tasks, like looking at a room very hard, it would be a weird thing to die. I'm looking at their records really hard, and I get a mind paper cut and bleed out.
You're going to have an allergic reaction to the drugs that they gave you.
That makes sense.
Is what's going to happen.
But since it felt like there was a low volume of pulls happening even as we got further to the end in the Mayan Cathedral, it didn't feel like there was as much tension as there necessarily could have been. I know Charles mentioned right at the end that our tower was getting precarious. I wasn't ever incredibly stressed out that it would collapse. But Shannon, and Bram, and I, and Raven, who is not here, play crazy man's Jenga.
And I think that's sort of the nature of the beast. Like, early on, we needed something to move us out of Act 1, but had it been, like, suddenly you were pursued by a psycho, we'd be like, well, we're making all of these pulls, so fuck that guy. Like, you're gonna make your early pulls, so you just need to find excuses to make it happen, such that later on, the checks that should feel like a big risk feel like a big risk because the tower is in a state where, like, if one of you is a fumble fingers, you will in fact have a bad time.
I don't think we had any particular fumble fingers here.
No.
Charles did, like, stomp around a surprisingly amazing amount.
I think I sat in one place, but okay. I recommend playing this game with your clumsy friends because I think it probably gets better if someone is capable of choking and failing a tower. Another possible problem with the way that the tower creates and enforces the pacing of the game is that after a person dies, after a tower falls, you get a new tower back, and it's worse. But it's still a much better tower than what you were dealing with. Mm-hmm. And the peril at the story level may be huge, but the peril at the actual character check difficulty level has gone down precipitously.
That was my experience, certainly. The first time I played Dread, I was actually the person who, near the end of the campaign, did die. Not even heroically, no, I just screwed up. And the rest of my companions basically were like, well, now we're scot-free and can escape this alien menace. Heck yeah! So yeah, I actually have observed that.
Actually, I was going to mention, just what Olivia mentioned, was that out of the group of us, there have been just me and her who have played a game of Dread previously, and I ran it, and it was just a module included with the game, I believe. Beneath Silver Skies, which, spoilers for that module, involved aliens. Iron Skies?
Iron.
Okay. Beneath Silver Skies is the name of a short story I wrote for class one time.
Iron Skies, Moon Nazis.
Oh, man.
There were no Nazis.
Were you there when we watched that movie?
Nor were there any moons.
It's so bad.
That movie's pretty bad.
Here it strives for satire.
They did the Hitler's downfall scene with their characters, and that was the best part of the movie. Just turn it off.
Yeah, I know that one. Yeah.
All right. Brief review of a movie aside. The game that I ran and the game that Olivia ran, though they were very different in content, they did have similar structures in terms of their tower, I think, and somewhat similar structures in terms of the ramping suspense factor?
I actually, they're very, very structurally similar. I couldn't figure out what the second act of my campaign should be, and so I actually went back and I read that module to figure out, like, well, what were they doing? Because the story of both the module and what I ran is, like, people go into a strange place, discover that it is filled with bad, and then leave. And I was like, well, but But the one we played had a three-act structure, and mine only has a two-act structure, so how do I get that third act in? So yeah, like, you are seeing similarities, you are right too. I built them in.
A similar thing that I noticed when we played this one, and again, it might have partially just been because it was a little late, but it was certainly the case that the suspense ramped up in my game that I ran, and then once Olivia died, dropped way down, so the rest of the people escaped from aliens, and it worked out pretty okay. And in this game, it worked sort of similarly in that we were exploring around, we were making polls, and eventually we had to confront the psychics in the Mayan Cathedral, and then we got through that, and we had to confront the psychics in the atrium.
The real world.
The real world, yes. And then Shannon's character died heroically. And after that, it was a little bit sort of mopping up, just in terms of, like, okay, well, we're probably not going to die from Jink now.
It seemed that we could maybe reach the front door, but there was the question, like, ah, is the front door open? We had to sort of, like, do some stuff. We had to find a way to open the lock. And then we were like, okay, is that it? There's still people around. Can we just walk out the front door? And the answer was, yes, you can just walk out the front door now. And if that seems like a slight anticlimax after psychic battles and heroic self-immolation, you'd be correct. Like, so that is a moment in which things quiet down and the falling action was indeed like, oh, I guess I can just walk out the front now. Alright.
Mind you, part of that might just be that in the end, our goal could be to have everyone survive, in which case it's probably a lot more tense if you go through and the tower never falls the whole game. But also part of the way that Olivia's game was designed, and my game was designed, was that you're supposed to make a lot of little polls throughout the beginning and the middle, so you get to that tense part at the end. And in our cases, the tower did fall. Maybe if you, dear listener, boys at sea, soldiers of fortune,
all souls,
any of you folks playing this game, you might all live, and that'd probably be your goal.
No, and that definitely, like, especially where the mopping up is concerned, I want to be clear, I am not a super experienced GM, so it always strikes me as wise to sort of leave the very ends of games alone. To be like, alright, so X is going to happen, Y is going to happen, Z is going to happen, and after that, something's going to happen. Because by the time the players and the characters get through, you know, the things that I make them get through, things become really, really unpredictable. And so I definitely didn't want to close very many things off. Like, do you guys want to just leave the Institute with these psychics, like, at large? I guess you can do that if you want.
And at least two characters arrived at the conclusion that, like, what was right for them was, I'm just here to get out. The mystery would not interest my character, and therefore I will not pursue it. Getting out the front door alive with all my limbs and my sanity intact is, in fact, going to be my goal. And, like, making it to the front door and getting out of it are what I'm going to do.
Yeah, when it comes to player character archetypes, I don't think we had a really, like, goody-two-shoes, let's all work together character. We were all a bit, not necessarily self-centered, we did work together to an extent, but we were mostly looking out for number one. So once shit really started to hit the fan, we kind of fragmented. And
yep, y'all played a lot of loners.
I tried to find excuses to build some sort of bridge. In fact, on my character sheet, one of my questions was, you wish you had a child like which one of the other characters? And I didn't have an answer for that before the session because I hadn't really looked at what other people's characters were. And so I had to sort of find an answer to that within the session. I settled on yours, actually. I don't know if that was clear. I tried to... There was a moment where we were both... Olivia S. and I were both canvassing a room and tried to, like, put together a bonding moment. Hating on hippies.
Hippie bullshit. There was at least one What the Bleak Do We Know joke.
Yeah.
Session. This is a gaming group that is not really big on...
You trendy humanist.
Nonsense.
I did try to instill all of you...
Slightly bigger on transhumanist goofball nonsense, but not new age not this transhumanist guy, yeah. Goofball nonsense.
I did try to encourage some sort of relationship with post-humanism in all of you, but obviously that was extremely subtle. Like, Charles's character had just done a lot of acid in college. Shannon's character obviously was literally a pastor. And I hoped... Well, Shannon's character was literally a pastor. Olivia S., I can't remember what your question was. It was one of the last ones.
Probably flipped it.
No, I don't think it was that bad. I asked Raven's character what she felt like the next step in human evolution was. And I was really sad about that because she was really interested in eugenics. And I exposed you to, like, horrible lobotomized people, and so I expected those two things to go together in an interesting way, but I don't think she even saw the lobotomized people. But regardless, I hoped to... I think
that might have been a player knowledge, character knowledge moment. Our lobotomized people were heavily implied. Like, if you see a person behaving in a childlike manner, having gained weight, obviously incontinent, and with significant scarring around the corner of one of their eyes, you might be a person who identifies that as, like, signs that lobotomies have occurred here, but I think that might not have scanned to the person playing a character who had a reason to have some thoughts about lobotomizing
people.
I think that
she was a character who, more than almost anybody else, was like, fuck you guys, I'm getting out. So I don't think she ever even saw those people. Like, I don't think she ever even encountered them. But I did try to connect everybody to transhumanism at least a little bit, and have it be a mystery and a monster that maybe keyed into that a little bit, so maybe that would generate interest, and obviously that did not work very well, which is fine, but like, that is one of the things that I tried to use the survey to do, is connect you all to my mystery.
That said, one thing that I thought worked quite well, my favorite part of the session actually was the Mayan Cathedral.
Okay.
And the way that worked, we already touched on it briefly, but each character had regrets in their past or fears or other things that they felt poorly about. And there was sort of a customized one-on-one experience that they each got to do where they had to try and overcome them. And it did mostly eventually come down to making a pull or making two pulls and trying to do a thing to confront or escape these in some way. But it felt like a pretty character-delving moment for each of them, I feel like.
Yeah, and this is definitely where the survey came in. I tried really hard. And if I had known that I was going to have a Mind Cathedral when I wrote the surveys, I would have tried to key into this even more, but I did read the surveys, like, several times, I did read them very carefully, and I did try really hard to figure out, like, well, what is at the heart of horror for this character, as far as I can tell? What is the thing that will be most upsetting to them?
And I think, looking back on it, one of the things I see in this discussion is I'm tempted to say, like, how do you do one-shot horror well, and what does this system offer to doing that as a genre? I think I would have moved that section closer even to the front than it was, because that is actually, like, we are five strangers who woke up in a strange place and didn't have a reason to trust each other, and we were thrown into a situation, and that breeds a situation which people do not get closer and do not get to know one another, because we're engaging in basically, like, goal-oriented escape behavior. Basically, we're playing Cube. And
how good would Cube be for a dread game, though?
No, Cube would be a fine setting for a dread game.
I've only ever seen Cube.
You have to.
Cube 2 have Cube's an amazing movie.
That's what I always hear.
Cube is really great. Do not believe friends.
But that was the moment in which we got to see beneath the surfaces that our characters had presented to one another. In fact, I went out of my way to expose as graphically as possible the fuck-upness lurking within my character, and to try and, like, make something horrible happen. The risk of, yeah, you know, recount all my own scenes from this in greater detail than everyone else is here, and I'm sorry, but I was confronted with a robot I had built in the image of my dead sister and had, like, managed to bring back to life, and had to watch as she failed and fell apart and begged for death, and I, rather than being like, opting for the simple answer, like, no, stay alive for me, we're not done, or, like, okay, I will make peace with your death and allow you to die, oh sister of mine, opted for the much more troubling, like, gradually taking parts off of her and disabling her physical capacities so that she could no longer injure herself.
Yeah.
Which involved basically, like, dissecting a human being on screen.
Yeah, I have to say, not to diminish Olivier's writing style, but that was, honestly, your Mind Cathedral scene was actually a bit more distressing than my character's was. It was very clearly very personal, and upsetting, strangely so.
No, you're, like you talked about, your cathedral scene was really hard to write, because I was like, oh, what is this character afraid of? What can I do with this? And so mostly, you know, like, I knew that she was a person who, like, builds up stress. So I was like, well, what if I just put her in an extremely stressful situation, you know, related to her job? But with Charles, I knew that his character had lost his sister. I knew that his character didn't want to let his sister go. I knew that his character built little robots for company so that he never felt like he was alone. And I knew that his character deeply feared building a mind or attempting to build a mind. And so I was able to put those things together to, you know, build this horrible, like, self-mutilating robot made of failure and sadness. And Charles absolutely worked very well within that to, you know, to reveal, like, central hypocrisies of his character where, like, he's telling his sister robot, like, no, 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 you're fine. This is you. This sounds like you. It looks like you. And then later, like, disconnecting her voice box so that, like, you know, well, it's not going to sound like her anymore. Like, is this even, you know, you were removing everything about your sister from this.
Yeah. I successfully made a human and then, faced with my own failure, dehumanized it in a fairly graphic way.
Charles was the only one who failed his mind cathedral session.
If you're planning to be a Dread GM, give your characters opportunities to fail or expose their flaws in this way. It will make them more interesting to the other players in the room, hopefully, and it will give other people something to play around, because something that, like, this scene happened in some way in view of all the other characters.
They were tiny Everyone robots else,
they were time. They were tiny robots at the time, and they all got to see, like, oh, this person you've been working with who appears to be mostly functional has something deeply wrong with them. And that's, I think that is a way to head tack more towards horror and towards suspense when you realize just who you are dealing with.
The other thing, you know, do not merely give your players opportunities to engage in that kind of behavior, but let them know ahead of time that that's what the game is about. Let them know ahead of time that, you know, that this is encouraged, that it is welcome, and that it will make the game better. Because that's definitely something that I didn't do, which, you know, as we've been talking about, resulted in my failure to create an experience that was as personal and as, like, highly upsetting as I was able to do for Charles.
One thing I have written down here is just about splitting the party, which we had quite a lot of during this session. I can't remember if it happened as much during the one that I ran.
No. I think we tended to stick together when you ran it.
It might somewhat be the nature of Dread, especially in cases where disparate characters are suddenly tossed into a pile and have to figure things out.
Yeah, I think that the fact that you were so disparate did lead to... You were so disparate, and no one particularly had, like, leadership or, like, the desire to bring people together. Like, that wasn't something I included in your surveys. So, you know, when the campaign that Bram ran, we were the crew of a ship, and we were trying to salvage materials to repair our ship so we could escape. So we obviously had a reason to stick together. We obviously already knew each other. Whereas in my campaign, I put 5 strangers in a room and went, go. Expecting that they would, like, introduce each other and not that, like, an atmosphere of paranoia and suspicion would develop immediately. Which, again, another thing that, like, oh, I learned that from this campaign. Give your characters a reason to work together or else they will not. But you were going to say about, like, the mechanics of splitting the party.
I should add, for the record, I think I already mentioned in my intro for the last podcast, I'm a pretty bad role player. Some of this can be blamed on that, probably. That said, in terms of Dread, I think it is the case that if the characters don't have a good reason to stick together, and sometimes I guess it might just be things are scary, I want to have someone with me, they might often split just because it feels like A, they're covering more ground, or B, they don't really have a reason to stick with these strangers. Like, my character did not know who these people were, did not particularly like them or trust them, and it didn't help that she was already just, like, a loner teenager. And she just wanted to leave, and...
And indeed, like, she... And because I put this in her questionnaire, she actively disliked Raven's character. And I think Olivia S. actively disliked Shannon's character. Mm-hmm. And Charles actively liked someone that he got to choose, although it probably wouldn't have been Shanna's character. Well, no, because it was that which of the characters would you have wanted to have a child like? And, like, you
I
two.
I would say that about an adult.
It's true, but you would.
Like, I wish my child were like that adult
I,
over there.
I guess you're
like,
right.
That probably says something if I feel that
no,
way.
No, fair enough. You're just adult men of the same age, so I thought, yeah. Like, this probably won't happen. It would probably be one of the younger people.
It was more the part that we share. Had completely different value systems, lifestyles, and things that you thought were important.
And Shannon didn't like you either, because you were a roboticist.
Ah, hey. And I'm like, what are you striving for, assuming you're striving for AI?
Ah.
True.
Which is a funny fact, because, like, actually, that is a thing my character feared more than loved. Yeah.
Yeah. Trouble working together. I know. Didn't we have two surly teenagers? In
yeah, no.
Party?
Raven's character was, was a pretty surly college student, and Bram's character was an extremely surly teenager.
Max surly.
Yeah, no, she was really surly.
I shouldn't have put in that much surl, but I spilled the surl pot and it all went in.
So if I did this again, and I was working with a team of strangers, I would probably, far from putting in reasons for them to dislike each other, which I was like, oh, this will be interesting, they'll play off each other in interesting ways. No. I would include more reasons for them to be working together and for them to like each other right off the bat.
I actually want to talk about an odd mechanical effect that splitting the party had. So, we weren't very far split. Again, this was a bottle episode. This took place within a single facility, spread across two floors. So, when we say we split the party, we're talking about being a couple hundred feet apart. So, if anything loud happened, we could reconvene the party pretty quickly to do party things. But what that meant is when there are, like, sort of three sub-adventures happening. What it ended up being in the third act is there's one person trying to get into an electrical control room to unlock the doors, another person exploring the doors and trying to figure out how to unlock them on that side, and I and occasionally Shannon were in the glass box in the center of the place trying to deal with the slowly awakening cosmic consciousness of the psychics. And what that meant is that when other people are out having their small adventures, when it comes back to me, and I'm going to try and make some pulls to survive psychic onslaughts, the people over there who are making pulls to scamper through vents, or unlock doors, or check rooms, are making my psychic battles worse. And there's a peculiar sort of resentment that results when you're like, oh my god, stop doing those things over there. Can't you see I have to survive a psychic battle with an awakening god consciousness?
And Bram is climbing through vents, and every time Bram was climbing through vents, she was like, yeah, I guess I'll make a pull to stay quiet. And I was like, this doesn't matter.
Really quite worried about that.
Yeah, a lot of the danger
kept on making pulls.
Was a red herring, and I'm not sure how effective that was in the end. Mm. As was mentioned earlier, the door ended up being wide open. There were three psychics on guard that it looked like they were on guard, but they were either in such a state that they wouldn't notice us or were dead. And so once we figured that out, my character just walked out.
The psychics actually...
be a good place to talk about the mutability of canon.
Yeah, okay, so briefly...
the psychics were a lock on the door.
Yes,
but
the psychics were holding the door closed. Mm-hmm. So you could have, for example, murdered the psychics in cold blood and opened the door for yourself. Like, congratulations, make some pulls to murder. But Bram went into the room that controlled all of the robotic doors and was able to override. So that's why the doors were open. And I was very surprised that you treated those psychics like such a threat. Like, I didn't expect that at all. I was like, no, they're not gonna move, they're not gonna do anything, they're sleeping psychics. And you guys were like, oh, fuck, don't wake the psychics, what are we gonna do about this? And I was like, yeah, huh.
And unfortunately, that should probably have been your cue to make them behave in a threatening or useful way
yeah.
to the plot.
So this is what Charles was talking about, where something that I realized in this campaign that I never realized before and will absolutely need to work on is that role-playing games have a funny relationship with the truth, which is that I can write pages and pages of notes about who something is and what things mean and what's happening and even the geography of rooms. But until I tell that to the players, it doesn't become the shape of the world that they're in. You know,
the
like,
waveform remains uncollapsed.
The light isn't white until I tell you that it's white. And so in a situation where I have written that the light is white and you are treating the light as though it isn't, like, I can just make it different. I can just change that on the fly. And I almost never thought to do that. And there are some sort of egregious examples of me just, like, sticking to my notes in a way that I don't think was very helpful, you know, when I should have been more flexible. And, like, the first and most obvious one is that I should not have waited for so long for you to encounter the psychics. I should have, at a certain point, realized, like, oh, okay, they're going to stall forever. I guess the psychics are going to have to hunt them. There was another moment where, I don't want to say Charles misunderstood what I had written on a map, but I had a very sketchy map that wasn't very clear, because I didn't actually expect to give it to the players. In a moment of flexibility, they were able to find some blueprints, and so I was like, oh, I guess we're going to find the maps I wrote. But the atrium in which the psychics were did not have doors. And Charles, and I think perhaps even the rest of the players, looked at my map and thought, like, oh, there will be doors there. And so, like, nearly enacted a plan that depended on there being doors to the atrium. And I was like, oh, sorry, you guys, there weren't doors there. And that would have been, you know, it would have been better and more interesting if I had chosen not to go with, like, what I thought was going to be the truth, because that's what I wrote in my notes.
I think I was even harsher. I said, like, insisting on architectural detail to the detriment of player experience and ability to plan.
Yeah, and it's not, I don't think that Charles is being fair when he's saying, like, insisting upon that. Because it's, you know, it's just so easy to be like, oh, this is what I had planned, and so this is true. Like, oh, you just can't do that, because that's not what the situation is like. You know, in the same way that a video game is pre-programmed. And it's not that, like, the game is insisting on its programming, it's that it can't change. And I was viewing my notes as something that couldn't change, or at least failing to view them as something as totally mutable as they actually are.
The nice thing about conducting a bottle episode is that you have built walls in. So the odds that players have to hit an invisible wall of, I haven't written this part of the plot, or I haven't written the mountains over there, so you know you really can't go to them, I'm sorry, is pretty low. But it was still something that we ran up against in this game. Like, there was the way in which the auxiliary psychics holding the door shut, so far as the players could tell, did nothing. They were just a very ominous, you know, potential monster lurking on the edge of our awareness that ended up not affecting it. We were just like, well, I guess that was, freebie. But the bigger one is that, like, our glass box psychics, who were the central antagonists, architects of the Mime Cathedral, and all-around story problem. It turns out that Olivia had not prepared for an attempt to make peaceful contact, or an attempt to solve their problems by, like, merging with the cosmic consciousness and trying to guide them away from whatever had turned, like, the rest of the ascendancy ritual to blood and death. It's worth mentioning, we have not talked yet, there were four people in this atrium, and, like, 30 bodies around them, in various states of disrepair, showing a variety of sorts of wounds. And so clearly something had gone very wrong here. My character tried to find a peaceful solution, maybe resolve it, maybe make nice with them, maybe psychic battle them until I could understand their otherworldly point of view, and I just beat my head against this thing that was, it turned out, a story wall, and I was unable to get that story wall to bend.
And it wasn't just a story wall, it was also just, like, I hadn't anticipated that, so I didn't have an answer, and so I was just, you know, like, we're acting in real time, and I, you know, like, in a moment like that, I was literally thinking, how can I make this work? How should these people respond? How can I keep these people, like, unworldly and threatening and weird, but also, you know, have this plan of Charles's where he's trying to make friends with them actually work? And on the fly, I could not, for the life of me, come up with a solution. So Charles just continued to ram his head against this wall because I couldn't build an opening in the wall fast enough. And I have one now, you know. I thought about it in retrospect and, like, oh, I got this. But, you know, it's obviously much too late.
Yeah. Eventually, in saddened, frustrated, and frustrated in, like, three senses of the word, Gordian knotted the problem with a makeshift sphere, which is to say, cutting out a lot of people's third eyes. Because I was trying my goddamn best to make sure some really horrifying things happen in this horror game. I was willing to be the agent of uncomfortable things occurring.
Luckily, part of the reason for this podcast is that we will also all become better players and better GMs probably as we do it. So, lessons learned, I think.
Right, fair enough. I'm worried that I'm making a fairly 101 point if I say, like, be ready for a certain kind of flexibility. But I think the takeaway is supposed to be that remember that things you haven't stated yet aren't facts yet. Like, until you've gone on record to your players about a thing, that is only a potential fact, and the facts could become completely otherwise if that's what, like, you know, if that's what the story calls for, if that's what the arc or direction the game wants.
For sure. Shannon, you didn't say much. Do you have any thoughts?
Oh, you guys are all so eloquent. I don't know what else to say. Eloquent.
Complaint that I did not get a chance to work in. There were a lot of take-backsies in polls, and that really, while that is in the rulebook, was tension deflating, where a character would be like, I am going to do this thing, and Olivia would say, all right, make a poll, and be like, well, maybe I'm not going to do that thing, which is okay to do a couple times, but it seemed like almost every time that someone was going to be required to make a poll, they would back out of it.
It's another moment, actually, I can't remember whether I did it or not, but I know that for me, those moments are about the fact that because every poll you make worsens everything thereafter, and it's not always clear what things are a level of challenge that requires a pull from the tower. It's a sort of transactional moment where you say to the GM, like, I want to buy this sort of progress from you, and you think the cost is free, basically. Like, I think I've said that I want to do a trivial task, and the GM responds, oh, actually, that's going to be $5. And you go, like, oh, at $5, never mind. And that's weird, because it's sort of, like, it discourages player action in certain ways, and I don't know if that's I don't know what kind of solvable that problem is, but I saw that problem too.
Yeah, and I definitely don't want to say, like, never do it ever, because Charles is right that it does, sometimes there are hidden costs to things that you don't necessarily see as a player, but I think perhaps what might have helped would be sort of talking about it before the game, like, say, this is the sort of thing that would require a pull. Basically, forcing a door open requires a pull, just to go through some things that happened in our game session. Looking really hard required a pull, scrambling through vents quietly required a pull, to sort of give people the base level of things that was needed to pull for. And Olivia did do that a bit, but I think that happened mid-game and not necessarily beforehand.
That's somewhat covering the rulebook, too.
Yeah. So I did not...
Talk about a counterfactual system for just a moment that occurred to me apropos of Dread. It's called, like, Dread 2 or Dread Boy Prime or something. Okay. Which is, yeah, Dread 2, Hyper Dread, I like that a lot. And that is Dread, but you used to play essentially, like, a comedy system. Which is to say, like, part of the problem is that the question of the threshold for what requires a pull and what doesn't is useful for horror because you can use it to ramp up tension, but... What's the maxim? Like, you know, don't make people roll agility to go upstairs, basically. But playing Dread in a roll agility to go upstairs world actually sounds like it might be... Like, it's possible that a certain unusual sort of comedy game can be run in that kind of a world, where, like, you know, the party gets up out of bed, that's four pulls, and walks down a hall, that's three. And before you know it, like, you're in a comedic world wherein catastrophic failure lurks around impossibly stupid corners. And I don't know, like, that might have to be, like, a half-hour game. But I wonder whether you can play Dread, A System of Hope and Whimsy.
Are you familiar with the works of Shintaro Kago?
No, I'm not. Actually, I know the name, but I don't
know. He's a Kuro manga author who does really comedic things with really horrifying art and setup.
That sounds great.
No, you should check him out. There's this short story that he does of Ikebana flower arrangement with aborted fetuses.
That sounds great!
The women abort their children and their ghosts show up around their head, so they start competing to have the most beautiful. I had a baby with men of every race, and I've got a beautiful multicolored.
Oh my god, that's
so good. They're really comedic, but they're horrifying. So I feel like that would be a very Dread in your Dread to Hyper Dread.
Yeah.
Dread to Hyper Dread available soon through Drive-Thru.
No, it is an interesting system. It provides a lot of weird challenges. Like, I was fairly satisfied. Like, well, you know, the low-stakes polls can be all this information gathering, because I don't want these people to have no idea what the hell is going on. And, like, the slow revelation of information is maybe, like, part of what is interesting about the story and even part of what is suspenseful and scary about it. So, you know, maybe these will be the low-stakes polls, and then when lives are clearly on the line, the tower will already be shitty. But, like, it is absolutely the case as well that, you know, like, the manual recommends, like, there should be a pull about every, like, 5 minutes or so. You know, so part of the decision-making process when, like, when somebody acts is, when you know, as the GM, when you're deciding, like, is this a pull or not, it's like, well, how long has it been since the last pull? How badly do we need this suspense right this second? And obviously, making decisions on the fly like that leads to flaws and errors. But I think it's, at least for me, it was part of the process.
Last thought on Dread 2, Hyper Dread. I'm still working this out in my head, but I think it's a system where you want the tower to fall, like, a minimum of 4 times. And possibly you don't kill people until, like, the second time, but after the first one, they get maimed.
Dread 2 Hyper Dread sounds more and more like even wackier paranoia.
Fair enough. I guess this owes a lot to paranoia. Play paranoia. And I hear that system is more abortive play than it is to read as a funny source book.
Sometime, maybe I'll have a little side podcast where I will talk about my experiences with paranoia, because I love paranoia, but it's possible I shouldn't.
Solo episode.
Solo, maybe, I don't know. Maybe I will. Maybe
I'm alone in a room with her voices.
We'll just talk.
Talk about paranoia.
We're going to turn this into a game design podcast. We're just going to slowly design and make better Dread 2 Hyper Dread, and it's going to arrive at your doorstep, and you're not going to know what to do with it, but it's going to be there.
But an easy way to make it so that Dread stays tense the whole way is, instead of making the tower, when someone has died, slightly shittier, just make it a lot shittier. Just, like, triple the number of things that you have to pull. And, like, do it as the host, so you're like, oh, this seems important, pull, you know, that the players would never do in a million years. That could be good.
Spite Dread sounds like could be something, yeah.
Spite Dread!
In conclusion, Jenga Tower is a pretty useful, like, tension creation device, but I'm not sure we have seen the final form. Like, I think Dread might be the 1.0 of a theoretical 1.5 or 2.0.
I think that's a fair thing to say. I do, in the end, quite like Dread. I don't know if that's the general feeling in the room.
Oh,
but
hell yeah. I enjoyed it. I would like to DM my own game of Dread.
That's a segment, right? It's like, we mean final words on things?
Yeah.
Yeah, we do final words.
Should you run this system if?
I love this system, and I would run it again. I would probably, like, pull extra after people had died. That's the first modification that I would make, but other than that.
Like every single gamer in the world, having played a system once, I believe that I could improve it. Because that is the sort of hubris that dwells in my species, and I cannot avoid it. So, yeah, I would play Dread again, I would make some modifications.
I think both of us, Olivia's, are big horror fans, so it was a pleasure to play with another horror fan, and I would, if you are, you know, enjoy making people spooked or jumpy or just really like putting together a tension-filled game that you couldn't normally do with a dice-based system, I would highly recommend Dread, and it was a lot of fun.
It's also hilariously sadistic. Like, you just get to look at your players and be like, yeah, okay, make a pull for that, and they go,
if you want to play a character from your childhood TV shows, this is the game to play. I had a lot. I really enjoyed it, let me tell you.
It's actually one of the original reasons that Dread was designed, I'm pretty sure, just to bring your childhood TV shows to life. I think I read that somewhere.
No, Shannon gave a lot of hugs. Some of them were ill-advised.
But yeah, no, in conclusion, we all mostly like Dread. It's not perfect, but it is very interesting, and Jenga makes for a pretty exciting alternative to dice, and it has some cool character creation bits. Just maybe make sure there's some kind of preset hierarchy or pre-existing relationships between the characters.
Yeah, no, like, be careful about how you construct narrative tension, have something to drag people forward through the plot, and avoid the system if you'd rather have a number that represents your agility than a 3-sentence answer that explains your feelings about your father as your character sheet.
Also, watch out, just like one tiny final note, watch out when you're writing the surveys for what you are forcing your characters to do, because there are plenty of players who are like, oh, I have a dead father, I didn't want a dead father, and are going to be annoyed by the directions that the questionnaire potentially pushes them.
But yeah, that's Dread. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time for Fate. I think Fate will be the next one, and we're going to be playing a world designed somewhat when we were designing in Microscope.
Good night, good luck, and give it to Fritz for me.
If Dread sounds like the system for you, you can find out more at tiltingandwindmills.com/dread. As for us, you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher, or follow our blog at parallelurl.com, where we have additional notes and writings for you to experience with your eyes. We also have an email at parallelpodcast@gmail.com or at parallelchat on Twitter. If you think any of today's hosts were peachy keen and you want to challenge them to a game of Jenga by post, you can find Charles and Olivia D. at genderfight.tumblr.com, Olivia S. at starsystemic.tumblr.com, or myself at wednesdayquestion.tumblr.com or at wednesdayquest on Twitter. Today's opening was an excerpt from the trailer for Beyond the Black Rainbow by Panos Cosmatos, and our closing music was Connection by Brian Boyd. Join us again next episode for either Fate Accelerated's take on our little paper world, or for a brief detour into a little game called Kingdom. Until then, lovely listeners, may your hearts be hopeful and your hands be steady.